This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Hey, it's 12:03, Friday afternoon, October 18th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hartz. Halloween bags will be probably getting less chocolate, while Thanksgiving could be a lot easier for cooks. We'll cover both in our next segment, but right now, consumers plan to spend 4% more this holiday season, driven by value shopping and cross-market retailers. That's according to the KPMG 2024 Holiday Survey. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Duleep Rodrigo, U.S. Sector Leader in Consumer and Retail for KPMG in Chicago. Duleep, thank you for joining us today. Now, this 4% increase, the prediction for the 2024 holiday season, how does that stack up to previous holiday season predictions?
Thanks, Rob, and thanks for having me. Yeah, we are seeing this 4% increase coming through fairly consistent data that we are getting both from our fall survey and our holiday survey, where consumers are telling us that they're planning on spending more for discretionary spend. And this year, we are seeing 49% of our consumers basically telling us that they're planning on increasing their spend this year across some of the key categories like gift cards and apparel and games. So certainly looking forward to a much healthier holiday season compared to prior years.
And then looking under the hood at some of the individual trends, interesting thing that jumped out at me, and that is households earning between $50,000 and $99,000. Those five-figure earners, they're going to increase their holiday spend by 10%. Does your research delve into why people want to spend more?
That's a very good question. We didn't really ask the question as to why people are spending more, especially in that category. But we're certainly finding that people are going to be spending more with as it relates to time with families and with both with travel and on food and holiday gatherings. And in particular, even this survey, even especially that segment of the income of household population did pop up, as well as the population of earners that are 200,000 and more also popped up with about a 7% increase in terms of what they plan on spending this coming year.
We're talking about the 2024 holiday shopping forecast with Duleep Rodrigo, U.S. Sector Leader, Consumer and Retail with KPMG in Chicago, and they predict that holiday spend will be up about 4% this year compared to last year. And once again, your research finds that online shopping is once again the clear consumer favorite.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are expecting, consistent with prior years, there's a preference for online shopping. About 39% of our consumers saying that they prefer to do shopping online. Most of these, most of the consumers plan on shopping on retailer websites. So about 62% of the consumers telling us that that's where they're going to go, and then 54% on brand websites. And it's certainly a certain number of consumers really getting pulled through social media and influencers as well, into various websites to shop this year.
And it seems like, according to your forecast, that people who are shopping for holiday gifts, they're searching for value. They're not going to fall in love with names as much.
You're right on point on that, Rob. As we look at value across all income segments, we have seen that price becomes the number one factor when consumers are trying to make decisions around where to shop and how and what products that they're looking at, regardless of brand. So as they look at pricing, they are willing to go down or move away from their brand preferences if they can find that value, a similar value with another brand.
Duleep Rodrigo, U.S. sector leader, consumer and retail with KPMG in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, an easier turkey and a move away from chocolate.
It's 60 Minutes of Financial Planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
We have a pair of developments in the food space today. One is Halloween centered. The other, a Thanksgiving breakthrough. We welcome in Phil Lempert, founder of SupermarketGuru.com, based in Los Angeles. Phil, thank you for joining us today. And I do want to talk about trends in Halloween candy. But before we get there, this innovation from Butterball, I'm not being sarcastic. I'm not being hyperbolic. It may very well be the biggest innovation in Thanksgiving turkeys ever. What are they doing?
I would agree, Rob. Number one, what they've done is they've created a turkey, and this is through the process that I'll talk about in a second, that you can take just from the freezer and put it right in the oven. You don't have to put it in your refrigerator where you don't have space for, you know, a day or 2 days to thaw out. Now, the way they're doing it is they've added a brine so it can cook right in the oven. It'll still be juicy. Now, I haven't tasted it, but they assure us that it'll still be juicy. I was on the Butterball hotline just about 2 hours ago checking it out, and they say it comes out perfect. But there is some downside to it as well. The average price for a frozen Butterball turkey is about $1.75 to $1.99 a pound. This one, $2.49 to $2.99 a pound. So it is slightly more expensive, but again, if you don't have room in the refrigerator, it's the way to go. But nutritionally, here's the big difference, and here's what people need to understand. For 4 ounces of turkey, it's 390 milligrams of sodium. Now, the normal turkey, the normal frozen turkey, is only about 100 milligrams, so about a quarter of that. Normal, 147 calories. This one's 170 calories. Normal, 2 grams of fat. This one is 5 grams of fat. So you are paying both nutritionally and monetarily for that convenience.
Now, another thought that popped into my mind, you mentioned the Butterball Turkey Hotline. If you have this this freezer to oven turkey with a lot of the brining and basting and all that stuff already, you know, baked in, no pun intended, does this mean fewer calls to the Butterball Turkey Hotline? Because that's one of the greatest kind of brand awareness campaigns I could think of. It's an annual tradition. Everybody calls the Butterball hotline, and therefore they're talking about Butterball turkey. What happens if there are fewer calls to that phone number?
It reduces their cost. No question about it, and I agree with you. There's going to be less calls, but still, they're going to be out there promoting it. Because even if you're not buying a Butterball turkey, a lot of people call the hotline to answer their questions.
And then looking ahead to Halloween, which is about 2 weeks away, chocolate out, gummy candy in, and is the cost of cocoa to blame?
Exactly, and it's just what you talked about in your earlier segment. It's all about price. If you look at the problems, and most cacao comes from South Africa. South Africa has had lots of floods, lots of droughts, lots of labor issues, so they've had to really take a lot of those cocoa trees and get rid of them and plant other products there. So that's one of the reasons that we're seeing this increase in price, less supply. And as a result of that, we're seeing a lot more other candies. But what I'd also recommend for a lot of people, think beyond candy. Think about healthier snacks when those goblins come up to your door.
Phil Lempert, founder of SupermarketGuru.com in Los Angeles. Thank you for joining us today with insights on innovation in Thanksgiving turkeys and on Halloween candy. Coming up next, the streaming service Netflix, they're on a roll.
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Shares of Netflix are higher today, coming off of its third quarter earnings report. We're joined by Ken Leon, Director of Equity Research, CFRA Research in New York. Thank you for joining us today, Ken. And what are some of the highlights in Netflix third quarter earnings report? It sounds like the password sharing crackdown continues to be a success.
Well, it's great to be here. So Netflix, we reiterated our buy. Our price target's $8.50. The stock's up about 10%, $7.54. They really hit it out of the park on all metrics. They exceeded consensus estimates. We saw strong mid-teen revenue growth. Margins have widened to 30% and even higher profitable growth than revenues. They did guide for the fourth quarter. There is a slightly higher increased spend of programming in the fourth quarter, so margins will come down just then. But we're seeing in all regions growth, and importantly, about 75% of their total revenue comes from North America and Europe, and that's where you have higher average revenue per membership on their plans, and they were growing 16%. So I like what we saw today. The delicate dance for investors with Netflix is, what are you willing to pay for a high-quality growth stock? And certainly the results that we had last night confirmed a pretty good outlook.
And then not only that, it seems like Netflix is really touting the growth in its ad tier, and that they believe that ad-supported Netflix could be a big driver in growth down the line later in this decade.
Yes, it's a fairly new area for the company. You know, it's $6.99 a month versus the premium, you know, which is $22, standards $16.99. So, you know, the premium customers are still critical, but it does get you volume. You know, we like it. And certainly as you look to other markets in Asia or Latin America, where the average revenue per month is lower, ad plans can be pretty attractive.
And then can you make a recommendation on Netflix stock? I mean, these are some pretty gaudy numbers that we're talking about here.
Well, we already did a few weeks ago. We raised our price target to $8.50. We're seeing nice movement in the stock today. And I would say for high quality, large cap portfolios, Netflix definitely should be there. And again, they are yards or miles away from their competitors who are just trying to do the basics in streaming and move from legacy broadcast networks to video streaming.
Ken Leon, Director of Equity Research, CFRA Research in New York, thank you for joining us today. Still ahead, an Entrepreneur Friday, helping innovators up their game.
This is Chicago's News, Traffic, and Weather Station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Documents are released from the election interference case against former President Trump. There's an opportunity to get a rare glimpse of a federal financial institution in Chicago this weekend. It's Entrepreneur Friday. We'll learn about a development program for people aiming to become world-class innovators. An expected drop in mortgage rates isn't materializing as many people expected. WBBM Business. The markets are higher. The Dow is up 13 points. The NASDAQ is up 122. And the S&P 500 is up 23. We have 63 degrees right now in Chicago under sunny skies at 12:31. Topping our news at the half hour, Special Counsel Jack Smith has released a large number of heavily redacted documents in his 2020 election-related case against former President Trump. They're from the public docket in which Smith details why he believes Mr. Trump should not be shielded by presidential immunity. The massive collection includes 2,000 pages and details messages, tweets, and other social media posts. Tomorrow and Sunday is Open House Chicago, with the public getting access to nearly 200 significant sites throughout the city. That includes the Great Hall inside the Federal Reserve Bank in the Loop. Federal Reserve System historian Jonathan Rose has his eye on the facility's million-dollar cube made up of stacked $1 bills.
Well, my kid's math teacher loves to find ways to help kids understand large numbers like a million. I told him about this cube. And I think it really helps just to see the amount of space that $1 million takes up. To me, it's not really an intuitive number. I couldn't have really guessed that this is what $1 million is.
The Great Hall features a four-story tall ceiling and 12 massive columns. It's 12:32 as the Noon Business Hour continues. Markets are higher. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager with MacroTides.com, based in San Diego. Jim, thank you for joining us today. And as as far as the NASDAQ is concerned, you might say it's a case of the tech-heavy index doing some Netflix and chill, especially today.
No question. Netflix is adding to the cause.
And then outside of Netflix, I mean, did that it was a very positive third quarter report, but did that come in above expectations? I mean, there's been a lot of consternation about media stocks and trying to transition into this digital world. And it seems like Netflix has left all of its competitors in the dust.
They continue to generate good content, increase subscribers, and the ability to change their pricing plan when they need to, Rob, is obviously a very strong story. So, you know, it's a well-managed company, and I think they're continuing to show it.
And then a couple of other story stocks that, especially one that we really haven't discussed in great depth on the Noon Business Hour, but stocks in uranium are especially are on a bit of a run lately, just because nuclear power, for the first time in decades, is not only getting a second look, but a great deal of investment as the tech companies try to find ways to a sustainable and also carbon-free method of generating electricity for AI and for data centers.
Yeah, the data centers consume an enormous amount of energy. Artificial intelligence consumes an enormous amount of energy, Rob. So these companies that are at the forefront of artificial intelligence need to get access to more energy. So they're driving it both with their demand, but they're also putting up the money. And I think the technology changes that are on the drawing board, if you will, also should calm some people's nerves regarding safety and so forth. The bottom line is nuclear energy powers about 70% of France's energy consumption, and they've been doing it for decades very safely. And I think finally people are maybe getting over Fukushima and other issues that have arisen over the last 50 years to accept that maybe nuclear power really can play a significant role in providing energy, but also helping the environment.
The stock market has managed to power over a lot of risk that we've been discussing over the last 2 years. And I guess the latest risk element that we've been talking about that could introduce volatility into the mix is the upcoming election. We're 2.5 weeks away from election day. I mean, people are voting right now. So I guess we're 2.5 weeks from finding out who wins. And even with that level of uncertainty about who's going to be in power and what economic policies could be pursued after Inauguration Day 2025, once again, the equity markets just seem to be powering over that worry as well.
They are, and I think primarily, Rob, because the equity market's focused on the economy. We continue to get constructive data on the economy. The Fed is still positioned to at least cut rates modestly, maybe not as much of as expected. I think one of the risks is we are not going to know the outcome of the election probably on November 6th. You know, a number of states like Pennsylvania don't start to count mail-in votes until Election Day. So a number of these key states, Rob, I think it could be 1 or 2 days beyond November 5th before those states can really be accurately called. And I think the biggest risk is that potentially whichever party loses, I think are not going to be very happy to accept it. You know, either the one party might say, well, the votes were suppressed, and the other party will say it was stolen. So unfortunately, I think the election could prove to be somewhat treacherous, given the divisive sentiment that unfortunately exists today in the country.
And then even after that, when it comes to sussing out economic policy and what the role of government will be next year and in the 4 years after that, you really have to find out the composition of Congress before you can really start making solid predictions about what's going to happen as far as Uncle Sam's management of the economy is concerned.
You're 100% right. Obviously, if VP Harris wins, she'll likely follow in the footsteps of President Obama and Biden. But if there's a Republican Senate and or House, you know, some of the things that she would like to do would be difficult. And the same thing approach, you know, goes for President Trump. If the Democrats have control of one of the houses in Congress, it's going to make that tough. And I think that's why Wall Street seems to favor the idea, Rob, of a split outcome, so that one party doesn't have complete control, because that provides some checks and balances to the whole process.
Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, Entrepreneur Friday, helping innovators reach new heights.
The only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Hey, it's Entrepreneur Friday. Chicago Innovation Fellows is a development program for people who want to become world-class innovators. It's a partnership of Chicago Innovation and the Northwestern Kellogg School of Management. We welcome in Luke Tannen, President and CEO of Chicago Innovation. Luke, thank you for joining us today. This is a great segment, Luke, I think, for people who listen to Entrepreneur Friday every week and they say to themselves, I want to take the plunge myself and develop an idea and turn it into my own business and work for myself. But then you think to yourself, how can I get that idea that's going to make a real difference and break out in a very crowded marketplace? And it sounds like this Innovation Fellows program can help you solve that problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on, Rob. So as you said, Chicago Innovation Fellows, it's a brand new practical innovation-focused leadership development program. It's actually more so geared for people at mid to large size organizations who want to innovate and bring innovation to their own existing organizations and really become world-class innovators. And it consists of a six-month cohort that's limited to just 20 high-potential leaders who will meet one full day a month. And here's what they'll do. In the mornings, they'll learn about innovation from Kellogg's top faculty who teach innovation. And in the afternoons, we're really going to embed them into the Chicago innovation ecosystem by having them meet and learn from some of the most successful winners of the Chicago Innovation Awards and other industry-leading innovators in Chicago. But here's what I think is the coolest and most unique part of this program. All of the fellows will be engaged in a capstone project that is aimed at pursuing a real-world innovation opportunity at each of their own actual organizations. And to help them achieve their specific project, each fellow will have their own Kellogg faculty advisor and Chicago Innovation Award winner coach. And we really built this into the overall experience to ensure that both the fellow and the organization that's sponsoring them are both getting a lot of ROI.
And when we talk about innovation, I think a lot of people believe that innovation is hitting a home run. It's inventing the iPhone. But you can also do pretty well hitting a solid single as well, because even though the iPhone was revolutionary, the guy who invented the pet rock, Luke, made $1 million off of it. So you don't necessarily have to hit the grand slam in order to do well for yourself in the age of innovation.
Well, an innovation means many things, right? It's launching new products, new services. It's innovations about processes, about business models. You can even, innovate the culture at your organization. So the curriculum of Chicago Innovation Fellows is really going to cover all these things. And in particular, here's the six-month rundown of what people will experience. First, it's going to kick off with learning innovation best practices. Then we move on to understanding growth through focus and digital disruption. Then we move to leveraging AI and IP in innovation, followed by talking about, how do we take a new idea to market? We'll then discuss culture, values, and leadership, and ultimately end with how to activate innovation within your own organization.
It's Entrepreneur Friday. We're talking with Luke Tannen, President and CEO of Chicago Innovation. And not only, I think one of the really great and very valuable elements of this program, Luke, is that nothing kind of fires up the brain like talking to like-minded people, and that maybe if you have a few ideas just popping around in your head and you don't necessarily understand how you can get them onto paper or turn them into an actionable plan, just talking to other people about it in the same field can give you some focus.
Yeah, that's a great point. So this program, it's not just about what you're learning, it's about who you are learning with. So that's why it's a cohort experience of up to 20 people, and you're learning from each other. And by the way, the people in this program, you don't just need to be someone in an innovation department. Maybe you're in marketing or operations or finance or IT, but you value innovation and you really want to become a world-class innovator. And that's also why we're really embedding you into the innovation ecosystem. So some of the classes take place at Kellogg, but others take place at innovation hubs like M-Hub, which is a manufacturing innovation center, or Matter, which is a health tech innovation center. So the idea is when you leave this program, not only have you acquired tools to become a world-class innovator, but you've really built so many tight-knit relationships with so many leaders in Chicago's innovation ecosystem that could power your own career and support your organization for years to come.
Luke Tannen, President and CEO of Chicago Innovation. Find him online at chicagoinnovation.com. Thank you for joining us today. Still to come, the Fed cuts interest rates and mortgage rates go up. We'll explain.
Because money matters. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The Federal Reserve cut interest rates by half a point last month, but it's not helping mortgage rates. Let's take a closer look with Rick Sharga, founder and CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County. Rick, thank you for joining us today. And when it comes to your mortgage rate, there are two forces at play, Rick. There's the federal funds rate, and then there's the yield on the 10-year treasury. And it seems like one wiped out the other when it came to trying to get a deal on a mortgage rate.
Yeah, it's important to remember that mortgage rates don't necessarily go hand in hand with what we're seeing from the Federal Reserve's Fed funds rate. They're much more closely aligned with yields on a 10-year U.S. Treasury bond. And those yields have gone up about a point since the Federal Reserve cut its rates. And mortgage rates have gone up accordingly. But what's also important to remember is that all of this is relative. Mortgage rates, even though they ticked up a little bit in the last few weeks, are still more than a full point lower than they were a year ago today, and are likely to continue to go down gradually, if not steadily, over the next 12 to 15 months.
And this also assumes that the Fed is going to stay on its schedule and cut interest rates by maybe a quarter point at each successive policy meeting, the first one coming up in November.
Yeah, there will definitely be a little bit of churn in the mortgage rates if the Fed doesn't stay on course. But the other thing we have to keep in mind is that the stronger the economy, the higher the Fed funds rate typically, and also the higher the mortgage rate. We've had some very unexpectedly good reports recently about job creation, about wage growth. And as good as those are for most people and for the economy at large, they also have a tendency to push mortgage rates up a little bit. So there's just a lot of moving parts involved in trying to figure out which way mortgage rates are going to go.
If you're going to put your home search into mothballs for the winter months in the upper Midwest and try to do it again in the spring, should you just kind of get over your fear of mortgage rates and just take the plunge knowing that you can refinance later on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. If mortgage rates do go down after you purchase a property, there's always an opportunity to refinance and lower your monthly payments, which you certainly can't do if you're renting a property. Trying to play timing games when it comes to mortgage rates typically is a fool's errand. The bottom line is that home prices historically go up over time, and that increase in home prices may offset whatever you save in a slightly lower mortgage rate. So find a property you can afford when you're ready for home ownership, and if you can do that, move on it, and don't worry too much about a quarter of a point here and there on your mortgage rate.
Rick Sharga, founder and CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County, California. Thank you for joining us today.